This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, good afternoon and welcome here today to our, I don't know quite what to call it, our panel discussion this afternoon on rugby league history. Today is the final day of the League of Legends exhibition, which is an exhibition which the National Museum of Australia has organised as part of the centenary of celebrations of rugby league in Australia. I should introduce myself. My name is Guy Hansen, and my role in the exhibition was as lead curator. There was a team of people who worked on the exhibition, and I had the great privilege of being the lead curator putting the exhibition together. It's been in Canberra now for just over 10 weeks. We've been very pleased with the response. We've had just coming up to 40,000 people through the exhibition, which is a fantastic result, and people have really enjoyed seeing their rugby league history. In doing the exhibition, we had a lot of assistance from a lot of people, and some of the most important people were the group which... there's a kind of a group of... a loose confederation of people which are called sort of rugby league historians. There's quite a range of people who are part of that group, and three of the most important ones are here today, Sean Fagan, Jeff Armstrong and Ian Heads, all of whom helped us prepare this exhibition, provided us with advice, directed us towards objects, let us know what had to be in the exhibition. And because of that, I thought it was very fitting that we finish the exhibition off with a bit of a discussion and let these guys come out and tell you some of the things that they think are important about the game's history. We're not going to attempt to give an exhaustive chronology of the game today, but each speaker will talk on a particular aspect which is of interest to them. Sean, our first speaker, is going to speak about the early period of the game, the events of 1907-1908. Jeff is going to talk about the history of rugby league photography, the great images that we remember, many of which, of course, are in the exhibition. And Ian, very appropriately, is going to talk about controversy in rugby league, which, of course, is something that is always associated with rugby league. So to kick off today, we've got Sean. Sean, if you're a rugby league fan and you're on the web, you've most probably stumbled on Sean at some stage because he's the author of that fantastic website, Rugby League 1908, RL 1908. And if you haven't visited it, I really recommend it. It's a fantastic resource for rugby league history. And he also has produced a couple of very important books on the early history of the game, including the Rugby Rebellion and most recently the revised edition of Daily Messenger's biography. So these are really very important books about rugby league history. So Sean's going to talk to us today about the early history of the game. Thanks.
Good afternoon, everybody. Friday night, everyone saw the test match, I hope. Greg Inglis's effort there on that, right there on the dead ball line. There's sort of a Bermuda Triangle of space at the cricket ground. Those of you who remember it, that's probably within about 5 or 6 metres of where Steve Geeran scored his famous try in 1980. It's also where Parramatta executed the wedge, one of the more famous moments where they put Ron Hilditch at the point, the heady point of a scrum, and ran straight at the Manly try line. But a long time before that, almost in that same spot, Daly Messenger in 1911 hurtled over the top of two New Zealand players straight into the end goal and scored a try. And he'd actually done that 4 years earlier in 1907 for the New South Wales Rugby Union team. At that time, he was by far the most popular footballer that we'd ever seen. There were 50,000 people at the cricket ground, 15,000 more than were there last Friday night. So you can see that number is an awfully big number. The players who played that day worked out that the £2,500 taken at the gate worked out to be £85 each, which is about a year's and a half worth of wages for an hour and a half's worth of football. So it wasn't too surprising to learn that footballers, working class footballers, felt that they deserved a better deal than what they were getting from the rugby union. Rugby union had started out as a sport based on amateurism. They'd seen in England soccer rise up in the 1870s and start professionalism. And the sport had been lost to the upper classes, been overrun by working classes and popularism. Professionalism came in. The same things were happening in Yorkshire and Lancashire, where rugby was particularly popular. But the rugby union didn't want to lose control of their sport to the masses, to the people. So they looked at basically living off this ideal of amateurism. They wouldn't allow payments to players for injuries, for time off work, wouldn't allow improvements in rules to make the game more attractive, because all that would have led to more crowds and more money, would have led to pressure to have the best players, buying and selling of players. So in 1895, that led to the Yorkshire and Lancashire split and the formation of what became the English Rugby League. It was called the Northern Union at that time. They allowed payments to players. Over the coming years, they made changes to rugby union. They got rid of the line-out, changed teams to 13-a-side, and introduced the play the ball. Now, those events happened 13 years before rugby league started here in Australia, but they were far from unknown when they happened. The New South Wales Rugby Union, New Zealand Rugby Union all wrote to the English Rugby Union at the time of the split, encouraged them and gave them the support. But it was very close to being watched here, and Sydney in particular was a very large working class city. We'd just been granted the Saturday half holiday, which meant that people were looking for cheap entertainment to both participate in and to watch. And that's when rugby started to become extremely popular in the 1890s. 1899, an English rugby union team came to Sydney. At that point, the captain of that team, Reverend Mullineaux, pointed out to the Sydney officials, New South Wales rugby union officials, that Sydney was showing all the traits of tending towards professionalism. The players were playing with a determination to win, pushing the rules to the limit, and there were accusations of players being paid. Rather than listen to that, the New South Wales rugby union officials told Mr. Mullineaux to mind his own business and to go back and sort out Yorkshire and Lancashire if he was really concerned about professionalism. So there was no real secret about what was going on in England. 1902, players in Sydney openly threatened to join the English Rugby League. But it wasn't really until 1905 when the New Zealand All Blacks went to toured England. They all went as amateurs. They got standard three shillings a day allowance when they were in England. They had to live off. They didn't get any money at all on the ship. That money basically was enough to deal with your laundry bill and not much else. New South Wales rugby union players, when they went to Brisbane, got that money as well. They reckoned that if they got in a shout at the pub, three shillings wasn't going to get you very far. Arthur Hennessy very famously said that after one rum and milk in the morning, my three shillings is done. So, which brings us up to 1907, when you've got those huge crowds, you've got the players feeling that they weren't getting a fair deal. A lot of the working class players wouldn't go on tour. They would say, I had work commitments, I was injured, simply because to go on a tour you had to spend your own money. So it was a bit embarrassing to have to go without the money in the first place or not be able to go at all and say I can't go because of the money. So they'd make up that they were injured, they'd make up stories that they couldn't get off work, which was affecting the standard of the New South Wales team. We could never beat New Zealand in rugby union. Messenger came along, performed his feats. We did finally beat New Zealand in one game. But by then, the move toward the split had already come. The players had teamed up with entrepreneur James J. Giltinan, Test cricketer Victor Trumper, and Labor politician Henry Hoyle, and formed the Rugby League in August 1907. They then played three games against a professional New Zealand team who were going to go to England and repeat that All Blacks tour in the hope to make similar money. Those players, they were accused of being professionals. They were called All Golds, on the basis that they were supposedly out for gold instead of being out for glory. But as it turned out, they each had to find £50, which is about a year's worth of wages, to buy a place on that first rugby league team. As it turned out, they did make the profits. They all got over 350 quid each, which is an awful lot of money. Now, that the success of that tour helped with rugby league's formation in Sydney, because when all the clubs were formed, James Giltinan was able to offer the chance for the Sydney players and Queensland players to join in a first kangaroo tour. Instead of asking the Sydney players to find £50, which none of them would have been able to, he went and borrowed £2,000 to fund that tour himself. as events turned out, that tour was ravaged by a very severe winter in England and labour strikes in the cotton mills, and they didn't make any money, and Gilton was bankrupted out of that. League also had its own problems when the game started in terms of its administration. But in the end, the game itself was the crucial issue. People had been saying, we want changes to rugby union rules. 50,000 people would go and watch a New South Wales, New Zealand rugby union game, but the headlines would say things like deadly dull. So they wouldn't necessarily want to play Australian rules or soccer. They wanted to play rugby, but we wanted to make it a better game. Rugby league delivered that. It gave two less players on the field, introduced the play the ball, and as it turned out, as soon as rugby league got on the field, despite all the off-field problems, it found immediate favour with the crowds and with the public. Rugby union officials openly admitted that if they didn't do something about it, in their words, the game would be as dead as Julius Caesar. What they initially tried to do, the rugby union, was increase player allowances, started providing jerseys for players, things that they'd refused to do before. But the game itself, as I said, was the main draw card. It's interesting to look at the play the ball rule, which has just come in England in 1906, so we started with that here. But in all the match reports I've read, there's virtually no references to the play the ball rule at all. They all talk about interchanges of passing between players, that they hadn't seen the extent of passing of the ball. That was the big difference. The scrums, they said, gee, they're a mess, but they're over in a flash, which isn't a lot different to today. The scrums seem to have improved in the 30s and 40s and then deteriorated again since the 1980s, which is interesting. There's also suggestions that rugby league should merge with Australian rules in Melbourne and create a national football code. Now that just seems, you know, a crazy idea now, but the match reports and other newspaper articles talk about rugby league being a halfway house between rugby union and Australian rules in terms of the way it was played. The held law, the rule about when you're held, the referee calls held, you've got to stop and play the ball. The way it was originally intended was closer to Australian rules. At the minute you were pinned and couldn't pass the ball, that's when you were held. At that point you had to drop the ball and it could be kicked in any direction with your foot, so which is very similar to Australian rules. Dally Messenger in 1911 topped the point scoring in Sydney. He scored the same number of points that Dave McNamara, the leading Victorian rules footballer, scored in Melbourne that same year. Both games were particularly similar. The only difference, obviously, was an offside rule. But even in rugby league, there was a lot of offside play, and there's still remnants of it there today in terms of you can't go within 10 metres of a fullback, but you can be offside. But those moves towards merging the codes were taken up seriously in 1908 in August in Melbourne. James Gilton said that when he went to England, he would take to the English Rugby League the idea that he could take the merge game and create a national and international aspect for football. It didn't quite work out that way. As I said, Gilton ended up bankrupted. Came back in 1909. He'd been thrown out of power. Trumper and Hoyle went shortly afterwards. But again, it was the game on the field that got the league through. A tour of New Zealand Maori team to Sydney in the space of one weekend, a Saturday and a Monday, brought in 50,000 fans and their money to the New South Wales Rugby League. That extra money helped then reinforce in the 1908 Wallabies team a confidence in the game, to the point where half of them defected to rugby league. A lot of them got up to £200 each, which was, as I said, a lot of money. But that would never have happened if the league wasn't starting to get back onto its feet. With the Wallabies in the league, in 1910, an English rugby league team came to Sydney. Now, the league had been kept off the cricket ground, been kept off the sports ground. It wasn't allowed to use those grounds. The rugby union had leases on them. The cricket ground actually wanted to host those games, which meant that the league was still forced to use the old Sydney showground. It's still there. If anyone wants to go and walk it and see a bit of history, there's a couple of stands still there. But at that point, the league got, you know, 40,000 crowds trying to cram into that small ground. There were 20,000 people turning up to club games. So in 1910 is really where the league started to take hold. And by 1911, the league found, with the work of the SCG Trust, a loophole in the New South Wales Rugby Union's lease agreement. The union had control of Saturdays and public holidays if they were on a Monday. There was a holiday, public holiday on a Thursday to do with, I'll just forget now, coronation of one of the kings, I think. So they got that Thursday and they got to use it, put New South Wales versus New Zealand on it, and 50,000 people turned up to watch the first rugby league game on that ground. Danny Messenger was the first player, rugby league player, to walk onto the field. And as if to mark the fact that the war was over against rugby union had been won, he performed the same feat. He ran at the New Zealand fullback, and rather than going left or right for some reason, he hurled over the top of him and landed in the end goal. Now, it was seen as a death-defying feat, and I think he just loved doing it, but there was actually a New Zealand footballer who tried it not too many years before Daly, who got flipped as he did it and went straight headfirst into the ground and broke his neck. 6 weeks later, he was dead. So that was Messenger's style. It was very thrilling. People felt they had to go and watch a game that he played in, because if you didn't go, you might miss something, which is what we want from all our footballers. You want to be able to go and watch and see something. You want to be able to see it and say, I saw it. Whereas back then, you've only got newspaper reports. You've got what people say. There's no TV. There's no radio. There were films taken at that time. None of them, sadly, exist as far as we know. The earliest films the guys had showing out here, 1921 or 22 Maori team here in Sydney. If you've got the time, have a close look at that. There's actually a play the ball in there under the old original play the ball rule. It's not the clean idea of having two markers and a guy playing the ball in a dummy half. It's actually more of a free-for-all. You just get to your feet, drop the ball, and all the forwards are sort of hovering around the ball, which is, I guess, the biggest difference over 100 years in terms of the rules. If you look at the play of the ball early, all the forwards are really contained in this one area. You've got 12 forwards, which meant that all the backs had all this enormous room. It was effectively a scrum, that the space you'd see from a scrum at every play of the ball. But 1926, the league introduced a new rule which streamlined the play of the ball, and that gave us the modern form of it. We only had four players involved and the other players were kept away. But by the 19... At that point, it was really, I should say, wasn't unlimited tackle football. It was more like one-tackle football. The last thing you'd want to be doing if you're a player was be tackled with the ball, because you could lose the ball. So in a 50-50 opportunity, you'd pass it, you'd drop it, you'd throw it anywhere. So it made for a lot more speculative play. But by the 1950s and 60s, players were learning how to drop the ball, place it back, drop it this far from the ground and make sure they kept possession. That allowed the forwards to stream out across the defensive line, which took away a lot of those gaps and produced bash and barge football. That led to the unlimited tackle football, first four tackles and now six. But you can see from that, instead of the forwards, everyone knows what's going to happen with the ball, which means that every player can set themselves in the defence and every player knows I can run at the opposition and try and tackle them. So in 100 years, we've moved from the play of the ball, having everyone around it and only having three or four players in the backs to oppose another three or four and all that space. And 100 years ago, those players didn't necessarily have the fitness or have the experience to make use of that space. But now that space is gone. And in a way, the game might be lesser for it. So I guess in conclusion, I'd say that rugby league really, in the end, it wasn't about payment to players, wasn't about compensation. It was about producing a game that everyone wanted to enjoy to play and to watch, and for 100 years, the game's delivered that. Thank you.
Some other interesting items which relate to Sean's talk, which are in the exhibition. You can see a series of objects relating to Messenger in the exhibition from 1907-1908, including his New South Wales Rugby Football League cap. And you can also see the pen used by J.J. Giltinen in meetings in the planning of the rugby league, which was very generously lent to us by Ian Heads. So there's some wonderful objects which actually illustrate many of the points that Sean was just telling us about. Our next speaker today, and another person who's assisted greatly with the exhibition, is Jeff Armstrong. Jeff is a leading sports journalist and a die-hard St George fan. He's also done a lot of sports biography, worked with the cricketer Steve Waugh, and he's also worked on a definitive history on Farlap with Peter Thompson. And most recently, he's been a very important part of the team which produced this beautiful book, The Centenary of Rugby League, which is by Ian Heads and David Middleton. But a lot of the image research, or if not all of the image research for this book, was done by Jeff. And it's in that context that I thought it might be very interesting, he having spent a lot of the last year thinking about what are some of the great images of rugby league in preparation for this book. I thought it might be great to get him here today to talk about rugby league photojournalism. And hence, that's why I've put the most famous of all rugby league images up behind Jeff for his talk, the Gladiators. So, Jeff, thank you.
Thank you, Guy, and thanks, everyone, for coming. Guy did just list a couple of the books that I've worked on over the last few years, but I need to ask, are there any rugby union spies in here today? And I ask that quite deliberately because I am currently in the finishing straight with a George Gregan autobiography, and I have this great fear that George might have sent a few people along the day to make sure I say nothing wrong about rugby union. So perhaps I should apologise to George straight up. The other thing that I need to say is I am going to talk about a few photographs today, but not just about photographs. I'm not a photographer. I don't pretend to be. In fact, I'd probably be one of the world's worst. But I did do a lot of the photo research for Centenary History. I am also a fan. I am a very dedicated St George fan, and so consequently I've seen a hell of a lot of photographs over the years. And I'd like to think that I know the difference between a good and a bad photo in the same way as I'm sure you all have your own individual opinions on what a good or a great photo is. It is true that I think that the most, I don't know if I've tilted this off, the most famous photo is the Gladiators photograph. And I should just quickly describe how the Gladiators photo came about. It's a photo taken at the conclusion of the 1963 Grand Final, which St George won. In fact, it's true that I was born in 1961, and it's true that since I was born, St George have won more Grand Finals than any other club. I should remind everyone of that. Saints won that game 8-3. It was a very controversial game, and as the two captains greeted each other at the end of the game on a very muddy Sydney cricket ground, a shaft of sunlight came down. It sounds a bit religious almost, but a shaft of sunlight came down on these two great players, and John O'Grady, the great photographer from the Sun Herald, managed at that exact moment to get that photograph, and it is just a wonderful photograph. But a couple of bits of trivia about that photo. One is that Arthur Summons at that moment is saying to Norm Proven, "You were bloody lucky." Because it is the Johnny King try that won the game was a very controversial one. And it does appear from oral history told by a few players who were involved that Darcy Lawler, the referee, might have been, shall we say, biased towards St George slightly that day. And to give you an example of how Darcy Lawler was capable of doing this, one of my favourite rugby league stories concerns a weekend. I imagine it was 1958, it could have been 54, but Great Britain played Australia on the Saturday, and as was the case through the 1950s, Keith Holman was the Australian halfback. And then on the Sunday, West played a premiership game, and Keith Holman was playing halfback for West, as he always did, and Darcy Lawler was the referee. And first scrum, Coleman puts the ball in the scrum, and Lawler whistles a penalty to the opposition. And then second scrum, same thing. And after the second penalty, Lawler looked at Holman and said, "You're not playing the Poms today." The other trivia about this photo is it's a wonderful photo. We all recognise that it's the most famous photo in rugby league history. But it didn't make page one. On the Sunday in the Sun Herald, it was actually on page three. And the story that made page one, it seems quite incongruous today, was of a train crash that had occurred outside of Dubbo in which 20 people had been injured. And on page three of the Sun Herald was that photo with a little story underneath, and alongside it, a slightly bigger photo, was the story of Lord Mayor Harry Jensen had lost pre-selection for the federal seat of East Sydney. So I don't think the editor of the Sun Herald quite realised what he had. And the other great irony is that the caption they put above that photograph was, "Who's that?" I mean, ask any rugby league fan today, they know exactly who that is, but in 1963, there was some conjecture. What I think this shows is that over time, the value of a sporting photograph can increase dramatically, and I think this is one of the great examples of that. But I think, in a way, it's been true since 1907. I mean, the Town and Country Journal in 1907 had a full page of photographs from the first New South Wales All Golds game. And it's a wonderful collection of photos. There's an impromptu team photo of the two sides. There's a great photo of Dally Messenger scooping the ball up, which shows just how athletic he was. And there's also a great photo of one of the Kiwi players making a dash, and he's wearing a wide-brimmed cloth cap to keep the sun out of his eyes. And there's some great stories from 1908. I honestly wish that a photographer had been at the Balmain Newtown game at Birchgrove in 1908 when Frank Cheadle, the great Newtown centre who died in World War I, he had a shot at a field goal, and as he kicked the field goal, the ball burst. First person to realise it was his Newtown teammate, Bert Andrews, who ran through, picked up the deflated ball and put it over for a try. And the referee awarded the try. There was nothing else he could do. So at that point, Bob Graves, who was Balmain's great front runner, he was the Balmain captain, he then went up to the referee and said, OK, that's a try, I concede that. But he's got to take the conversion with the same ball. But the referee said, no, you can take a new ball, but just to add a punchline to the story, the kick at goal from right in front was missed. Which reminds me very, very quickly, I shouldn't tell too many stories, but another great story I found when I was researching the East history, which I wrote with Ian and David Middleton. It's a story from a Balmain East game in 1931. And as you may remember, some people may remember, in those days, Saturday papers were published all day. There was a new edition being published on the hour, usually to contain the latest race results. But anyway, in the break between reserve grade and first grade, there was a paper boy in Eastern Suburbs colours who was walking around and he's yelling out, "Piper, Piper, get your paper, terrible Balmain tragedy, paper, paper." So obviously the Balmain fans think, well, what's going on? So they rushed up and everyone bought this paper and they're flicking through and there's nothing about any tragedy at Balmain. So one of them says to the paper, well, what's going on? And he said, have a look at the stop press. And in the stop press there was the third grade score, which was East 23, Balmain 0. It's a funny thing with photos. I mean, that's probably the most famous photo. I reckon if we were asked what was our most favourite photo, I think we'd all have different answers. I know the papers of today tend to want to have photographs of arty photos. I don't mean arty boots, and I mean, you know, Craig Golding and Tim Clayton from the Sydney Morning Herald were both magnificent photographers, but they take photos of arty moments. I love breaststrokers with the water coming off, when I reckon the great photos are famous moments or dramatic moments. I'm not sure. I mean, you'd have to help me. I didn't see the papers yesterday as yet, but I don't know if Greg Inglis's great moment, whether it made any of the newspapers, or whether... I did notice that the Daily Telegraph's front page was a glorious photo of the members' stand, but so be it. My favourite all-time photo, well, now I'm biased, it's a photo of Ted Goodwin. It's the photo that appeared on page one of Rugby League Week in 1977 after the first drawn grand final. It was taken by another great photographer, John Elliott. And it's a photo of Ted had blood down his face. And just for me, it's my favourite because it reminds me of my favourite day in football, sitting on the hill with 69,000 fans. And it also takes me back to the first time I went to the football, which was at Cumberland Oval in 1971, when my uncle took me to a Saints Para game and Ted dominated. One thing I remember about that is my grandparents lived at Westmead, and so to get to the ground, we had to walk over Parramatta Park. And I remember seeing, as we walked out of the ground, there was a kid there with the corner post. Remember the old paper corner post? And he was the guy who'd won the dash for the corner post, and he sort of competed with Ted Goodwin to be my hero. And I thought, one day, I would like to get that corner post. But it also reminds me of the day Ian Schubert headbutted Ted Goodwin in the 75 grand final and cost Saints the game. And it also reminds me of another moment, and this is a very personal moment, which was at Wynyard Station in 1979. Ted Goodwin was the star player of the 77 season. He and Rod Reddy were the reason Saints won in 77. And then he had a horrible year in 78 and left St George at the end of 78 and when he went to Newtown and had another terrible year at Newtown in 79. But Saints recovered to make the grand final in 79, and there was a very meagre promotion where the fans got to meet the players at Wynyard Station. And I, as a St George supporter, went to this, and I can remember Craig Young on stage with his red St George shirt, which had Albert, his nickname Albert, under the badge. But the only autograph I got that day was after I walked out to next door was a building site. They were building a building right next door to Wynyard Station, say about 20 metres from where the St George first grade grand final team was on stage. And Ted Goodman was working as a labourer there. And I mean, I had a 5-minute conversation. He wasn't bitter. It was just life. And of course, Ted came back to have some good seasons with Wests after that. But it was just another who's that moment, almost a who's that like that. Ted Goodman had been the star of the game in 77. 2 years later, He was a labourer on a worksite. And just again, it's that who's that moment. Another who's that moment, which I know this photo Ian's going to have feature in his presentation. It was a photo that was taken, so I won't be up there now. So it was a photo that was taken in 1932 during the Ashes series, but it's one of the wonderful photos from the State Library of New South Wales collection. But it's captioned Rugby League at Sydney Cricket Ground, and it actually appears in the Centenary History as well. And it took a fair amount of research to work out what it was, and I'd just like to quickly take it through you. The first thing we did was work out that because of the jumpers the England team was wearing, that it had to be 1932. Fortunately, the England player had a black armband on, so we were then, by going through the game after game, clarify that there was only one game on the tour that the England team had worn the black armband on. And finally, we were able to determine that, well, luckily, the photo actually appeared on the front page of the Referee, which was the Sporting Weekly. And so we were able to write a caption that then said that great Australian second rower Joe Pearce competes with England centre Stanley Brogdon for the ball. And it was the England v Metropolis game at the Sydney Cricket Ground. That was the caption. But the reason I say all this is to demonstrate some of the work that goes into these historical books. It would have been easier just to put a caption, you know, Rugby League Test match. Would have been wrong. It wasn't a Test match in 1932. But we went to the trouble of finding out exactly what was occurring in that game. And again, that meant that instead of Pearce and Brogdon being unknown players, who's that, we were identified two great players in a really pivotal moment in an important game, and just show how athletic these footballers were. Another thing about that photo, in the background of that photo, is the crowds are huge, and I think it just shows just how big rugby league, how entrenched rugby league was by the 30s. Sean's alluded to that with the way the game grew. And I think between the wars, club football really grew into being an important thing. And it really entrenched rugby league in the Australian psyche, or at least in the New South Wales and Queensland psyche. I mean, to the point that I think rugby league in the 30s was as iconic, if iconic's the right word, as Farlap, as Bradman, as The Bridge, as Sir Charles Kingsford Smith. And it was so entrenched in our psyche that not even Super League could beat it. And as we've seen today, the game has just grown to... It tends to grow every year. I remember there was some quite silly talk in the papers during the lead-up to the test in Sydney about crowd figures being down. I mean, that was just silly. Crowds are actually up. Whether that means there are more people passionate about the game, I'm not sure. But just in terms of faces through the gate, there's no doubt. The star of that in the 1930s, the person, it's quite extraordinary going through the photos. It's a slow and laborious process, but if you ever had a chance to get on the State Library of New South Wales website and just do a search for rugby league, there are some wonderful images from the 30s. It's astonishing how many times in those photos Dave Brown appears. It's almost like, I know he wore headgear, that was his trademark, and he stood out, but it was as if the photographers were drawn to him. I think it was because he was that good a player. Brown was he was known as the Bradman of league. I think he scored 385 points on a Kangaroo tour. His records are mind-blowing, 45 points in a game. I think he scored 38 tries in one season. I'm not sure about that. I'm going to clarify that. But he was East captain at 19. He was Australian captain at 22. He's just a great, great player. Which brings me to a bit of a bugbear of mine, which I'd like to just sort of go off on a random thought. It concerns the team of the century and the process of selecting the 100 greatest and the team of the century, which I was involved in. And the thought that Brown didn't make it, I feel that was a great shame. And I will get back to it, though, because I'm not sure who I'd put out to put Brown in. But I just, talking about the 100 greatest, I just thought I'd explain just a couple of things. It's amazing how some players have, over the years in history, have been forgotten, and other players, their reputation has grown. A good example of that concerns Sean's mate, Dally Messenger, who in, I think, 1940, Sean, picked a best ever team. But the team he picked was a team of guys he enjoyed playing with. Though I know the guys he would most like to play with. It wasn't his greatest team. It was so that every player in that team he would either have played with or against, except for one. And the bloke he picked was a bloke called Harry Capels, who's an interesting story. Capels was a 5'8", who came into Sydney football in about 1916, played for East, went on the Kangaroo Tour in 21. By 1923, when East won the comp, was probably the best player in the game. But then he went to Melbourne in 1924 to try with Harry Sunderland, the great administrator, to establish league in Melbourne. Then went to Queensland in 25, was never quite the same player, and has been forgotten. And I sort of compare that to a bloke like, and I don't like criticising players, but a bloke like Steve Roach, who was an outstanding front rower, but I think over the last 20 years his reputation has improved. I think all of us, if we think back to what Roach was as a footballer, I think he made the top the 100 greatest players easily, and I found that a bit surprising. And whereas a bloke like Harry Capels, I think he got 3 votes out of I think there was 70 people, 68 people voted. So it is interesting how those voting can change. I was privy to the voting of the 100 greatest. I was also involved in the selection of the team of the century, and it was interesting some of the biases that came about in those two teams. It was one really interesting process. I know that the Australian team of the century was announced recently and was the team was paraded before the test on Friday. That Australian team includes 10 players who played football in the 50s and 60s and 3 guys, Meninga, Lewis and Johns, who I would describe as modern players. Queensland have also picked the team of the century. I think they picked it last year. They also include 10 players from the 50s and 60s and 3 modern players. And I think that just says something about we always go back to the heroes of our youth. When we've got a difficult decision between a modern player and a really old player and the guys from the 50s and 60s, and I think that bias was enough to sort of just modify that what the eventual team of the century was and squeeze guys like Messenger, who made the bench, and Frank Burge, who made the bench, and Brown, who didn't even make the 17, squeeze them out. Again, I'm cheating because I'm not going to say who should have been left out to put these guys in, but I think it is a shame. And it was interesting because I know Ray Chesterton in the Daily Telegraph ran the line in the papers about a possible Queensland bias in the selections. I didn't see that, but I did see that bias towards the 50s and 60s. And yet, as Ted Goodwin's my favourite player, I think if we were all honest with ourselves, we'd probably look back to the 50s and 60s and 70s and think, yeah, the players there are pretty good. And it also, one other thing on these, the process of picking teams of the centuries and 100 greatest, a great example of how this process is not definitive, and I don't think anyone is pretending that the team of the century is definitive, is the situation that's now occurred with the hookers. Noel Kelly was selected as the team of the century hooker. I think in 2005, maybe in 2004, the Rugby League had a promotion to pick the team of the 60s, and Noel Kelly could have been the hooker in that, but he wasn't. It was Ian Walsh. The team of the 50s hooker, which was a promotion done the year after, is Kevin Schubert. And yet Kelly, Walsh and Schubert are not in the Rugby League Hall of Fame, but Ken Carney is. So you've got this crazy situation where it just doesn't make sense in one sense, but what it really does is just underline how, well, I was going to say undefinitive, that's not the right word, but how these processes just can't be perfect and no one should pretend that they are. But I just wanted to end with one final thought, because I was going to say I wasn't going to suggest who should or who shouldn't be in the 100 greatest or the top team, but there's one bloke that I reckon shouldn't be. It's Arthur Summons. I never saw Arthur Summons play. He's before my time, but you look at his record, he played 9 test matches, which is not a lot. He never won a premiership. He was captain coach of the 63 Kangaroos, but he didn't play in that series because of injury, and when I look at the fact that Barry Muir played halfback and Earl Harrison was established as the 5'8 that season, I'm just not sure where Summons would have fitted into the 63 Kangaroos. And yet, since that photo's taken, since the Gladiators was taken over the last 40 years, Arthur Summons' reputation has grown and grown and grown to the point that he made the 100 greatest no problem at all. And you know what? I don't think on playing ability he should have, but his status in the game purely from that photo, I reckon he's entitled to get in just for that. I just want to end with the thought that never, ever can you underestimate the power of a great rugby league photograph.
Okay, well, we'll come to our last panellist this afternoon. And, of course, it's Ian Heads, who is one of the most distinguished rugby league journalists and historians we have, the author of numerous books. One of the ones which I particularly like is True Blue, which was a really important reference for the history of the New South Wales Rugby League. Of course, the new book, which has just come out, and numerous biographies of rugby league identities, I think including Jack Gibson. Is that right, Ian?
Four books
on Gibson. So I can't really say much more than that. A very important historian of rugby league. And I think the talk today is called A Game for Racehorses.
It is.
Here we go.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, hi there, everyone, and thanks very much for coming along. Thank you for your interest today. Yes, the title, I'm going to do something very brave here today. I'll make an admission at the start that I'm a bit of a dinosaur when it comes to the technology. Matter of fact, I've only just worked out how the typewriter works after all these years. I'm quite impressed, I've got to say. But my wife, being a little bit more upmarket than me, has prepared a bit of a PowerPoint presentation. They're just some images that reflect this great game. They go right back to the beginnings. Some of them cover the territory that Sean and Jeff have covered. So if I can get things to work properly, I'm going to make my small contribution today. It'll be a little bit like a match, I suppose. It'll be bits and pieces of things that happen, a bit of a grab bag of events that that happen through the years as different events happen in a football match. So just with the title, that some of you may be aware of that. Arthur Hennessy was the great South Sydney hooker of the beginning years, and when he first read the rule book, the Northern Union rule book, when it arrived out from England, probably the start of 1908, he read the rules and that was his quote. He obviously saw it being a game for quickness and a game where there was going to be more movement of the ball. So that quote has stuck down the years. And there was an interesting thing that sort of evaded the media the other day. Unfortunately, when we launched the big book, we had he captained the first Australian team to play a test match here against New Zealand in 1908, a hooker, Arthur Hennessy, and a hooker, Cameron Smith, captaining the team the other night. And we gathered the two of them together. Cameron Smith launched the book, and there were nice photos taken of Arthur Hennessy, the grand-nephew of this Arthur Hennessy, who has this Arthur Hennessy's cap, one of the beautiful caps. There's some in the exhibition, I know. But the media moved on to other things, didn't take a lot of interest in that, but it was a lovely, a strange coincidence, really, after 100 years. Anyway, I won't linger on that because I've got a few pictures and things to show you, so we'll start. The first couple of images are just, they're most historic. They're this New South Wales team against the New Zealand All Blacks, known as the All Goals, in 1907. And what you're looking at, really, in my view, is heroes of the game, early game. The blokes who took a punt on this new game, rugby union players who saw something different, something better. That's Sydney Showground. Crowd of 20,000, the first match, I think, Sean, that one?
That's the cricket ground.
That's the cricket ground, that guy. Right. I'll move on. That's the collected teams from that year, 1907, James Gilton sitting in the middle. Again, I come back to the point, absolute heroes. Some of them, you know, there was a chance of blokes putting their jobs on the line. There was a bad feeling abroad in Sydney, certainly a division between the two rugby, the old rugby game and the new one. And the game owes an everlasting debt, no doubt, to Gilton and Albert Baskerville, the New Zealand founder, and these players who did what they did. That's the great player, of course, Dally Messenger, the master, that jumper that we saw the other night, which I thought looked terrific. He was a marvellous player. Sean's touched on that, some of the freakish feats. No doubt about what he was. He was a champion, and his nickname indicates that. I've probably been as interested in his life after football, or aspects of it, the fact that he's probably representative of the breed of players who sometimes struggle to match in their later life, their continuing life after 30, when they finish their football careers. It's not an easy thing to do. It's interesting, I'm just doing a second book with Shane Webke, who's a popular bloke, and he's got a lot of things to say about football, and he sees today's players probably going to hit the wall even harder than some of the others, because he thinks they live in something of an unreal world. Boys in a bubble, that type of syndrome, being full-time professionals their whole life focused on rugby league, and suddenly they wake up one morning at 31 and there's a whole lot of living to do, and some of them really do struggle with it. And I think Dally was one of those, probably, although he had a pretty fair life. He managed a couple of hotels and he had a banana plantation. Had a bit of a falling out with the league here in Sydney, and died finally in 1959, but he's remembered with great affection and should be. These cartoons, I think you saw this one a little earlier, they just give an idea of the division back then of, the wealthy rugby union arguing against the tempted player going across to the new game. And again, notice that rugby league's represented by the devil here on the bloke with all the bags of money. Whereas the angel is on, the rugby union side of the fence. So that was the paper sort of split down those sort of lines. You know, were traditional. Some were supportive of the new game. Some were not. Some didn't want to see. They thought it was the most dreadful thing that ever happened in probably the history of Australia. So these sort of cartoons emerged. This is. I know Sean talked about the Maori team that that came out here, 1908, 1909. It's just, I just wanted to reinforce the point, and it's been long forgotten over the years, I think, and it was raised. Jeff and I are on the Centenary Committee, and it was raised that there's a sort of a debt owed to the Maori teams of those 2 years too by Rugby League in Australia, because by coming out here, by being very extremely popular with the crowds, drawing big crowds, they helped fill the coffers of the Rugby League Code, and they helped the game build a foundation for what it became in the years ahead, and yet it's been overlooked to an extent. I actually argued for perhaps a Maori team and an Aboriginal team to be added to the World Cup at the end of the year as an invitation basis, just as a special one-off thing to thank both Indigenous groups for their contribution to rugby league. But that was shot down. But I do think there's a match point going to be played before one of the Origin games of a Maori team against an Australian Aboriginal team, and I think that's right. The next four pictures are all of the same thing, but I just thought I'd share it with you. This is the RMS Macedonia, which sailed August the 15th, 1908, and took the 34 players plus manager Giltinan to England. It was one of 10 steamers built for the P&O line in the first decade of the 20th century. It carried 377 first-class passengers and 187 second-class, and I think you can probably guess where the kangaroos travelled. They travelled second-class on one-way tickets, in fact. And when the money ran out, which it did over there, some of them had to stay back. Quite a group of them, I think about 10 or so, stayed back to play football for English clubs to get enough money to come home. The English League had to fund the rest of them to come back. So it was a very tough tour. But what a great adventure. They took off from Sydney. They went via Colombo, Aden, Portside, Marseille. They attended a bullfight there. They got very involved in shipboard life. Attended fancy dress balls and concerts, and they played cricket against the first-class passengers and beat the first-class passengers, thankfully. And to keep fit, some of you will have read this, they worked regular shifts at stoking the ship's boilers. The other thing they did was to practice the war cry, the sort of forgotten thing about Australian rugby league, that for many years the Australian team, as the New Zealanders, the Aussies had a war cry, and it lasted until 1967 Kangaroos used it, actually, and some of those old kangaroos can still chant it. They can't do the jump at the end anymore, however, rowing to their knees, having long since collapsed. I've tried that out with fellows like Noel Kelly and others. But it was a symbol of that team, and they did it when they arrived at the Tilbury Docks in 1908 and was described by the media as having a weird and awful effect. But they then headed into a brutal winter, one of the iciest, coldest winters in many years in England, and also into the strikes that closed down the cotton mills of Yorkshire and Lancashire, kept the fans away. Tremendously tough tour, 45 games. They played £1 a week, was cut back to 10 shillings a week. Again, the fellas who went away, that's a lovely colour shot of the boat, on that ship were pioneers, and we all owe them a debt too, I think. These are a couple of things that I just thought I'd show you because they're very pretty and very special. They're touch judges' flags. They're from Rugby Union, actually, but beautifully woven pieces that were presented to the presidents of the respective leagues around about 1911, something like that. Again, there was a suggestion the league might have done something like that this year. They haven't done it, but these are treasures from the past, obviously. This is something that, it's a picture of the East team of 1913, in fact. Dally Messenger in front, that's the great shield there that's in the exhibition, the Royal Agricultural Shield, presented to the game, 1908, a beautiful thing. Was presented to Dally Messenger by Easts in recognition of his contribution to the club. They'd won three comps in a row, and Jeff Armstrong became involved in this very many years later when it became the subject of dispute, the shield, between the Messenger family and the Rugby League. It had been loaned to a Hall of Fame in Sydney, and the Rugby League attempted to retain the shield. But ferreting in the library one day, Jeff found a paragraph in the Sydney Sun, I think, Jeff, wasn't it, of Claude Corbett, the great journalist of that time, had recorded the fact that the shield was presented to Dally Messenger in 1913, and the league took that. John Quayle was in charge then, a good straight-shooting bloke. He took that on board, and the Shield came back to the Messengers and now lives so comfortably here within this great museum. That's just an example of early media, I guess, a beautiful thing, Town and Country Journal. They're the captains of 1914, I think it is. 1914 photos of the club captains involving some of the great players. Chris McKivitt up the back on the left, Boxer Russell in the Newtown gear, Bob Craig of Balmain, Sandy Pearce, as Jeff's been talking about, Albert Brumman, the North's captain, Billy Cann from South's, and Tedder Courtney. So a lovely piece of artwork, that. That's probably my favourite photo, actually, from the book, if any of you get to see the centenary book. There's just something, to me, something wonderfully atmospheric about that photo. It's an afternoon in 1928, Sydney Cricket Ground, St George versus West, just a game of footy being played on the ground, a few people on the hill, the old grandstand still there, and this rather ominous figure in the foreground with the shadows cast onto the ground. And you can probably guess that that's it's in fact the photographers, two of them standing there, and they used to shoot with those old cameras, so they had to hunch over to shoot. But there's just something about the atmosphere of that photo that I really love. That's something that Sean uncovered in his relentless trawling for rugby league history, and it's just a lovely pin that was part of the kangaroo adventure of 1929. And if we had one now, it'd probably be worth a lot of money, I'd imagine. That's Daly Messenger with Sandy Pearce. Sandy Pearce, the great hooker. You'll notice there he's got crutches under his right arm. That's coming home from the Kangaroo Tour 1921-22. He broke his leg on that tour, but Sandy Daly was there to greet him. That's the photo, Jeff, I think, that you were talking about. That's Joe Pearce and Stanley Brogdon, the most unusual angle, I've got to say. I've seen Joe looking better than that. Joe's making the tackle. Again, it shows the quality of the photography at that time, 1932. I mean, that's a lovely sharp photo capturing the atmosphere of the day and the great crowd there in the background. This is the following year. This is the, a decade later, actually. This is the last day of 1933. It's the beginning of rugby league in France. We're not quite sure who that is. Possibly Alan Ridley. Do you think it's Cliff Pearce? Yeah, the Australian three-quarter playing against for Australia, obviously against England in Paris. This was the game that began rugby league in France, and we talked about Dave Brown earlier. That's Dave Brown in the very distinctive headgear there, backing up down the middle. Australia had lost the Ashes that year, but they won in a hand canter this day. They won. Looking for the score, 63-13, I think it was. So a great game for Australia, a match played in ice and snow, as they so often are in those northern winters. That's just a shot from the 30s. Jack Lynch, the East winger. Jack went on, his moment in history came when he managed the 1963 team, the team that set all sorts of records, captain, as Jeff said, by Arthur Summons. Jack died in a very rugby league way, I suppose you could say. He was a committeeman at the for East of the New South Wales Rugby League, and he collapsed and died at a committee meeting one Monday night in about the mid-1960s. That's the war cry we're talking about. Not sure of the year, based on almost certainly on a genuine Aboriginal war chant from a tribe on Stradbroke Island, actually, so it had a genuineness about it. It was certainly a very popular part of those teams. Of the tours, I don't know about the players probably had mixed feelings about it. There's a group, Clive Churchill in the middle with his tie flying. A group in the 50s doing it with their gear on, which must have been a little bit harder, I'd say. As I said, 67 was the last time it was done, the famous bowler hat tour, when strange events took place in the streets of Ilkley. And then for 1973, there wasn't another kangaroo tour for 6 years after that, because the World Cup came in the middle of that. And it was dropped for reasons that have never been explained. I think perhaps it was to do with the team leadership just didn't want to do it. The team was led by Graham Langlands, such a great player and a great captain coach, but a very shy man, Chang, not demonstrative in nature at all. And I don't think that Warcry would have sat very comfortably with him, and I have the feeling that he may have had something to do with it being left off the agenda in future. So we've never seen it from that day. But the word still exists. It talks about going to battle and fight, and all sorts of things like that. That's just a very destructive shot of Ray Steer, who has the distinction of being sent off, had the distinction of being sent off in two out of three tests in 1936, the only time that's ever happened. But he also had the distinction one day of nicknaming the great Clive Churchill. It was Ray Steer on radio who said famously, "I never saw the master play, but today I have seen the little master." And that, of course, stuck forevermore with Clive, certainly one of the greatest players that any of us have ever seen. These are wonderful pictures. Organised by Jeff and the photographic team he had with him, which show how rugby league played on during the war. There's three of these pictures, quite amazing, really. This first one it's at Hiroshima, about 14 months probably after the dropping of the atomic bomb. It's Australian soldiers from the British Commonwealth Occupation Force, crew members of the HMS Shropshire, playing on a cleared field in Hiroshima, August the 6th, 1946. So a really remarkable photo, I'm sure you'd agree, and I don't know if you could switch the clock back now. You wouldn't want to be playing there, that's for sure, when what we know now about the nuclear world, you wouldn't want to be there. This is Armistice Day, 1943, Papua New Guinea, probably Port Moresby, and there's a 1937-38 kangaroo, Charlie Hazelton. I think that's Charlie behind the cup, Jeff, is it not? The shirt on the left, with the shirt off. Look, that's right, looking on. A field... the match was described as the final of the New Guinea Rugby League football competition between a field ambulance team and the Hazelton-led artillery side. And then the third in that triumvirate of photos. This one takes us to Syria, Tripoli in Syria, March 1942. A really boggy field there. The game played in teeming rain on a quagmire between... the 2nd, 13th Field Company and the Royal Australian Engineers. There's a familiar face there you'll recognise. John Raper was in great form the other night. He was inducted became a life member of the Sydney Cricket Ground, which meant a lot to him. I'll tell a quick story I told Jeff, actually. There the badge and marvellous honour, it puts him with Bradman and Benno and so many famous people, but gives him a carte blanche to the Sydney Cricket Ground. But Chuck had it in his mind that it probably meant... He talked about how he'd spent a lot of time in the bar downstairs, which he certainly had. But he talked about how it was his belief probably that it meant free beer. You know, you get free beer. So he actually went, during the evening, during the test match, he actually went down and tried it out and was severely rebuffed and said that, you know, you have... We appreciate you have that, but, sir, you have to pay for your beer. I'll tell a quick story about John. He's such a character and he shines rugby league. He's one of those players that's just he'd still love to be playing if he could. I think my favourite story with him is the day he took his very understanding wife, Carol, back to England to the to relive, you know, the kangaroo tours that he'd been on. And he wanted to take her back to the Troutback Hotel at Ilkley where the team, 63, a few teams stayed there, in fact, and just to show how what it was like. And so they arrived at this grand Yorkshire pile on the corner and it was now a nursing home. So they went in and John, he's pretty good on the chat, John, you know, and he spoke to them at the front desk and he said, what, stayed here? And they were a little perplexed, but they said, oh, by all means, have a look through. So John took Carol through and showed her various rooms. This is where Billy Smith brought the sheep up here and this is where, this is the room that so-and-so axed down the door and all that stuff. So it was great, you know, and he said goodbye to the staff and they headed off. They spent an hour or so. They headed off down and drove a little further towards Ilkley. There on the next corner, with a big sign, was the Troutback Hotel. You've been in the wrong place, Chuck. It's a very John Raper story, that, really. That's the great Chang, the ultimate warrior, obviously. great controversy about him missing the team of the century in the top 13. He made the 17. He was always going to make that. One of those impossible choices. How do you leave him out? I don't know. You know, it must have been a terribly close vote. We're never going to know because the 28 or 30 of us all voted independently. We don't know the answer to that. The votes may be released one day, but I suppose his omission from the team was probably the biggest shock of the lot. But, I'm sure you'd all agree, those who saw you play, what a fabulous player he was. We've probably never seen a sidestep like it. I just put that one, and that's John Brass, who's sort of that link between rugby union, one of the players who crossed over very successfully and had great success with this. It was just something I heard the other day. I didn't know. It's funny how you learn little bits as you go along. He was the victim of a bomb threat before the grand final of 1975, yeah. And John quite wittily tells the story about when the team ran out onto the field, how he suddenly noticed there was a lot of space around him. It was a death threat. It wasn't a bomb threat, I'm sorry. It was a death threat. So there was a lot of space around him. And he figured, well, the other players might have been a bit worried that the threatener may have been a bad shot. So they gave him a wide berth. But Ron Coote told me something the other night. I never knew that the photograph for that match was not done in the traditional way. Because of the threat to Brass, they were photographed in some enclosed place, probably the dressing room. I'm not quite sure. And I haven't had a chance to have a look at the photo to check that. But a very good player, John Brass. Lovely hands. There's three famous identities, if I could put it that way. John Kerr, looking, Sir John Kerr, looking remarkably sober there, I've got to say. It's the grand final at 75. Arthur Beetson, such a great player, Arthur. He's missed a couple of big events lately, which is a bit sad. He's a wonderful bloke. He's just a little impulsive at times, and it was a shame not to see him at the Team of the Century dinner. And in the background, Kevin Humphrey, such a strong leader of the game, who's sort of was brought down perhaps by his own problems, but he led the game strongly for 10 years and now, sadly, is doing it very tough. He had a bad stroke recently and he's certainly not well. I was just going to tell you two quick stories off these. I'll probably... you can hook me off, Guy, if you want to. That's a photo. I'm not quite sure when or where that was. There's some identifiable people in it, obviously. That's Ron Willey in the middle of the background, Ken McCaffrey next to him. Harry Wells in the front row, and I'll just concentrate on McCaffrey and Wells. With the death of Jack Gibson, I thought again of this photo because Ken McCaffrey, a terrific player, Ken, and a terrific league bloke, really. He represents a link with a great coach of the past, with Duncan Thompson, who was the inspirational coach at Toowoomba days, and Ken played up there, and created this contract football, which was a very exciting brand of football, where everybody had a responsibility to get the ball to a man in a better position. So Duncan Thompson, certainly one of the most influential coaches in history. I don't know where he ran in that coach of the century thing, but he could well have been second to Jack Gibson. Lovely thing is that blokes like Ken McCaffrey and Wayne Bennett today, Wayne Bennett is steeped in the Duncan Thompson story and philosophy too, that those things are carried on. I think that's very important. The reason I've got Harry Wells... Harry Wells is a wonderful bloke, and he was a great centre, obviously, and one of my all-time favourite stories about rugby league involves Harry. Harry had... he's a very genial, lovely fellow, and if any of you have met him, you'll know that. He's a couple of great interests in life. He loved his football, certainly, but he loved birds more. He's been a big bird collector over the years, and he's always had aviaries and still has them, in fact. Parrots, a particular fancy, I've got to say. He told a story one day about... a match down somewhere in this region. He may have played at Crookwell or somewhere. I'm not quite sure. I've never tracked down the exact details. Young, was it? Yeah. Okay, good. And he anyway, it was a grand final, the match, apparently. Harry was towards the end of his career, but he was, I think, playing in the centres that day. And it was a very tight game. His team were behind near the end. And the ball came out along the line, and Harry made a half break as he could, a really strong, powerful centre. Pass to the winger, and the winger shot off down the touchline with a great roar from the crowd. But at the moment he passed the ball, Harry heard a noise overhead, and he stopped on the half and he looked up, and there's a flock of gang cockatoos flying over the ground. So anyway, the play carries on down the wing. The winger keeps going. Flurry of action in the corner, and the winger scores the try, and it's the winning try, as it turned out. Great excitement. The crowd's up in there, as you can imagine. They're all looking for Harry to congratulate him, and they turn back, and there's Harry on the halfway line, looking at his beloved gang cockatoos. But he did love birds. He said once, I love my football, but he said, I think I love birds more. And Norm, just very quickly on that, Norm Proven told a great story about Harry too, about when the state team used to go to Brisbane, Harry would fly. Those are the days they started to fly up in those days. Harry would inevitably go to the Queensland Brisbane markets on the day before the match, and he inevitably would purchase some cockatoos or parrots or galahs or something. And so he'd now have these birds that he'd have to bring back to Sydney on the plane, which is not the easiest thing to do. So anyway, they'd smuggle the birds onto the plane, and they'd have to be tucked under the seats, obviously. And the players were under instruction, if and when the birds started to squawk, the players had to kick up a fuss or start singing or make a racket to a distraction so Harry could get his birds home. So that's Harry Wells, a lovely genial, great rugby league man, Harry. That's, of course, Noel Ned Kelly, one of the great characters of the game, now the hooker of the century. And as Jeff said, that was a controversial selection, but Ned would have let nobody down. He's the only front rower to go on three kangaroo tours. Terrific player, but a bigger personality probably, and invented the philosophy of football, which comes under the heading retaliate first. That was always Ned's policy, and he was sent off, I think, 18 times. Although he always argues strenuously that quite a few of them were for technical scrum breaches, you know, and he was in the hands of Darcy Law and people like that. But just very quickly, I had the pleasure of interviewing him and Ron Curt at a function which announced the 100 players of the century recently at Kirribilli. And I asked, probably made a mistake actually, but I asked Noel about how he'd go in scrums now, what he thought about the game. So, and he gets a bit stirred up about this. He's not too happy with the trends in the modern game. And I'm going to use the phrase that he used, so you'll excuse me if I do. But so he finally got steamed up to the point. He was at sort of white heat about this. He's not happy with a lot of things, you know, in the forwards, these weak scrums and that sort of thing. And he paused and he took a breath and he said, you know what the scrums are these days? He said, they're a poofter's paradise. And it brought the house down. It was quite a distinguished crowd, you know. It was just Noel saying what he thought, and he always did that. I'll just finish with these two images because they're about what a lot of people are talking about in the game. It's what Noel Kelly was talking about aspects of the modern game, and it's probably always been a situation where players of particular generations have thought it was better back then, you know. But there's quite a lot of that now, and I think Sean and I have been doing some work on a film that's upcoming, and that generation of players, I think it's fair to say unanimously, Sean, they've all got reservations about the scrums and various other things. That's a fair dinkum scrum. That's Laurie Spooner and, well, sort of semi-fair dinkum, Laurie Spooner and Greg Alexander a few years ago. And the other aspect that often comes up in discussion is that the game at times can be too formulaic, that some teams with this 10 yards, easy 10, get the 10, then kick, get the space and eventually put the kick up. And a lot of tries are scored by that, by the ball in the air. Competition for the ball has gone from the scrum, gone from the play of the ball. Competition in the air is about the only true competition for the ball. And a lot of tries are scored that way. Now, it's evolution of the game. It's just what we have. But it's been very interesting exercise. I think Sean would agree that a very interesting exercise that, to a man almost, the players of that era, and we're talking about some of the great players, have got reservations. And maybe it's time the league, and this year would have been a good year to do it, had some sort of a really high-level meeting to just step back from it, come back from it a bit and say, look, have we got it right? Are there things we could do to make it better? Anyway, I'll leave that thought with you. And again, thanks very much for your interest and thanks for coming along today. Cheers.
I'd like to thank you very much for coming along today and being involved in this little celebration of rugby league history. It's been a wonderful exhibition at the museum. We're really happy with it. Next stop is Brisbane. The Queensland Museum will be up there for State of Origin. We're then coming down for the finals at the Powerhouse Museum and the World Cup. It'd be very interesting to see how the World Cup goes this year. And then we're going to Townsville and then on to Melbourne. So League of Legends, the tour goes on. Thank you again, and thank you to our panellists.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.